Okay, so the class is, like we said, hopefully maybe about a 12-week or so exploration of this book. It's a book I've shared with people many, many, many times over a long period of time. In fact, I read this book for the first time in 1996, in the summer of 1996. It was published in 1994, and I loved this book. I was not an aspiring Baal Tshuva from, I wasn't searching for Yiddishkeit. I was searching for a good book, really, when I was traveling in upstate New York and was in, I can't remember the name of it, in Woodburn and bought a book. And so, but I find this book to be magnificent for the beginner and for the advanced student alike. And it's pretty amazing to me that that's the case. As many or maybe all of you know, about 2.5 years after I read the book, I met the author's granddaughter. So my wife is the author's granddaughter, and it's very special, and it's actually quite wonderful to read it now because rereading it now, and I know Zadie, pretty well, regrettably because of my own lack of attention to the possibilities, not as well as I probably could. And I just hear his voice and his tone. And if you, probably many of you are familiar that he's written many books. He's an extraordinarily well-published columnist. You know, he writes in Mishpacha magazine now in the Jerusalem Post, and he's spectacular. And he has a certain way about him that I may even point out tonight in some of the words that is, on the one hand, very calm and friendly and southern and disarming, and then on the other hand, like an assassin who just gets the bullet right in there. So he might even describe it as sort of like setting up a batter with a couple of outside pitches before coming inside, And so he's just extraordinary, and he doesn't need my approbation, but it's a great schuss for me to know him as well as I do and to make this presentation. In fact, I copied him on the email to the shul today that we were giving this class, and so he joked that he wishes he could attend, and I have a lot of good stories about him. He's a beautiful person, and he's actually quite open to spending time with anybody who asks him. So, he lives in Beit Vagan in Yerushalayim. He's a very young person for being the age that he is. He's just an exceptional person who wrote this book after the conclusion of a 39-year career as the rabbi of Congregation Beth Jacob in Atlanta. He went to Atlanta in 1952, left in 1991. I say left, but that's very far from the truth. He's there regularly, and the Atlanta community has over 100 families that have made Aliyah. So he's actively engaged in their lives till today, till this very day. He said to me several years ago, I said, Zadie, what do you do with your time? He says, I do what I always did. That we have 100 families that live in Yerushalayim. He says, the only difference is now I don't get paid. And so I could go on and on about him, but the time doesn't really allow. I'm just saying that he's so qualified to write this book, and very open to discussing it and sharing with people if the opportunity presents itself for you. So, in taking notes on the first chapter, I have too many notes for tonight, and so we'll see what we get through. And feel free if you read the first chapter. I didn't give any instructions, So maybe you read longer, maybe you read shorter. But if you read the first chapter and you have anything you want to discuss or ask or anything on what I say, then please interrupt. But I want to start from the introduction on page 7, which is expressed in Roman numeral 7, where he writes, right from the opening sentence, I think it's before that. It's before that where you have. There you go. So right at the beginning of his words in the introduction, he writes, Jewish life today is in the grip of communal schizophrenia. The level of Jewish illiteracy and ignorance has reached new lows, while simultaneously traditional Jewish learning and scholarship is growing ever stronger. The incidence of intermarriage and dropouts is alarming, but the incidence of returnees to classical Judaism gives one hope. All this is a reflection of the fact that we are becoming two societies, those on the periphery of Judaism who are inexorably fading away, and a solid core that grows ever more intense and committed. He wrote this, as I said, in 1994. It is so much more true today than it was then. Because then, in 1994, for example, there was that year, it's a little bit later than that. In 1998, I think it was, in 1998, I'm pretty sure it was, there was a completion of the Shas and page-a-day Talmud study. There were 40,000 attendees at that event in two stadiums, or maybe approximately 40,000. The CMS Shas that took place just a couple of years ago, there were 90,000 attendees. You know, and there are far, far, far more Jewish organizations of traditional learning today than there were in 1994. Almost every community kollel in America, and there are dozens, is post-1994. Very few, like maybe fewer than five, are before that. And there's a huge amount of Jewish learning going on, and at the same time, there's a much huger amount of distance from Yiddishkeit. And so he writes that he's speaking to both of these groups. He's speaking to them about principles and belief, and he's speaking to those who are returning, that it can serve as ideas to illuminate the way home. So in a certain way, he's not speaking to the firm world. He's speaking to those who want to explore the firm world or don't want to. That perhaps they have something to be said for them. Now in chapter one, and we'll go to that, he says time and time again, he playing the rabbi's role, says time and time again that there's no goals. And I know a family that he's known for over 50 years. And so they live in Atlanta. They're still members of his congregation. They have family members here in Arizona. And every time I see Mrs. whatever the last name is, she says, "Oh, we're Rabbi Feldman's greatest disappointments." You know, and it's not true. In other words, even though maybe they didn't transform their lives in observance, if you would know, it's totally untrue. First of all, their families, their lives have been enriched by their relationship to Yiddishkeit, even though there's no line in some sand that he was reaching for, or that Torah per se is reaching for, that if you don't want to go this far, then don't get involved. There's nothing like that. So there's tension throughout the conversation. And he reaffirms that the tension that this young man who comes to speak to him is talking about is as if, like, maybe I'm wasting my time unless I'm willing to go all the way. And he's just saying it's totally untrue. It's totally untrue. But he does say that the exploration should be serious. He does say the exploration should be serious of how can Torah improve your life? How can it impact your life? So he's talking to everybody, and if he was talking to these groups then, it's even more appropriate now. I want to tell you something that I heard from Rabbi Mutti Berger, who is a very, very long time teacher at Eshet Torah in Jerusalem. Rabbi Berger is an American, but he's been in Eshet Torah for about 35 years, or maybe longer. Longer than that. And he said something really fascinating, which I think is also at the tension of this first chapter time and time again. He said, the reality is that Jews who don't observe Torah for generation after generation after generation, eventually, and it's not such a long eventually, are no longer Jews. They fall off of the Jewish cliff. But we all know that by trajectory of how many we were 2,000 years ago, we should be hundreds of millions of people, if not over a billion people. So what's happened along the way? What's happened along the way is an irony. And later on in the first chapter, we'll point it out, Zadie talks about a journey, and the journey which involves excitement and fear and challenges and disappointments and the like. So like I said, there's a little tension here, which I can even feel as I express it at this table. There's a little tension here, but it deserves honest analysis. And here's the tension. The tension is that on the one hand, people who are Jewish remain Jewish even if they choose not to observe Torah. And that's different from other religions. In other religions, you would define the word, like a Christian, as somebody who believes in Christianity. If you define the word Jew as somebody who believes in Judaism, you have no idea what you're talking about. Right? Because every one of us knows thousands of Jews that don't believe in Judaism. And God forbid, I am not going to pass judgment on them, and nobody else should, say, you see, you don't believe in Judaism, so you're not Jewish. That's not true. Right? So we know that Jewish does not mean...
What do you mean by Judaism?
I mean Torah, authentic Torah. Let's not get into any further debate on that. Okay? So somebody doesn't believe in authentic Torah. Well, let me rephrase it. I'll define for you the word Judaism. Okay? The belief in the monotheistic God of Abraham, who gave the Torah to the Jews at Sinai. Okay, that's what Judaism means. So many, many, many Jews don't believe that. And they think that it's all going to work out. It is all going to work out in that generation. And it may work out in the next generation. And it may even work out in the following generation. But if you ask anyone, this is Rabbi Mati Berger's position. If you ask anyone, how long ago did your family observe Torah? How many generations ago was your family Torah observant? Most people will say, and now it's a younger generation already, most people will say, my grandparents or my great-grandparents. They might say their parents, but they'll say, my grandparents or my great-grandparents. There is no incidence of people who will say, my parents were not observant, and my grandparents were not observant. My great-grandparents were not observant, and my great-great-grandparents were not observant. You will never find a Jewish person who will say such a thing. Because the person who would theoretically say that statement has already been lost to the history of the Jewish people. So that said, the Rabbi Berger points out, if there's been 100-something generations since the giving of the Torah, let's just say in 3,300 years, there have been, for argument's sake, 150 generations, right? So, and there's probably been more. So let's just say there's been 150 generations well, maybe there's fewer, but let's just argue 150 generations. That means that if somebody is asked how many of your generations have been Torah knowledgeable, Torah observant, Torah involved, no one who answers under 145 exists. They don't exist. If they say, yeah, well, it's optional. You know, you can be Jewish and not observe. You can in your lifetime. And maybe for a generation or two or three, maybe. But no one can say 141 generations have been observant, and nine have been non-observant, and here we are. Doesn't exist. So the stakes are very, very high. But that's also good news. It means that everybody is not that far away. Everybody is not that far away. Everybody is part of a glorious family of tzaddikim and talmidei chachamim, of great people. They may not be so aware of that. But everybody who calls himself Jewish is part of that glorious reality. So the tension, like I said, the tension is high because on the one hand, there really only is the returning or the fading. That's the reality. That's who he's speaking to, the returning and the fading. All there is in between is the people in a holding pattern between returning and fading. But I want to tell you the last thing on this page of encouragement. After that U-turn, let's say a family is one of those 146s out of 150. So they're a 146. Then they make a U-turn. after that U-turn, it takes exactly zero time to catch up with everybody else who's been engaged the whole time. After the U-turn of the penitent, or whatever you want to call the terminology, then they have this kid in first grade. And that first grade kid is sitting next to another kid in first grade. And the other kid in first grade, he's the Rosh Hashiva's grandson. He's the Rebbe's great-grandson. He comes from a famous, amazing Jewish family, blah, blah, blah. There is zero gap between those two kids and their Jewish potential. So the U-turn makes for immediate back in the game. That's fascinating. It, in our own lives, maybe not like myself, like, okay, if I didn't study for the first 70 years, maybe I can't become the world's greatest scholar. Although Rabbi Akiva tells us that if he didn't know to read Aleph Bet at 40, you can become the greatest Talmud Chacham of all time. Right? So, but yet, immediately in that family's life, everything is back to the exact same potential. That's the power of tshuva. It's beyond, it's unbelievable, fascinating. Okay, so that's what I have to say on this page 7. Like I said, I think what I said was wrought with tension. That's real sort of intergenerational, galactic, you know, like tension. So if anybody has anything you want to say or question or argue on this point, it might be good because I got about 100 other points. No? Okay, then let's continue. I think I'm saying something very far from that. No, I'm saying that...
You're saying if you don't observe the Torah exactly, then it's no good.
I didn't say anything like that, no.
No.
I'm telling, but I will say something a little close to that so I can clarify the point, the difference in what I was saying. I will tell you that there does not exist a sixth-generation non-observant family in the Jewish world. It doesn't exist. It's gone. When you come to celebrate the 50th anniversary of organizations Judaism of various types, let's just call it that, you will usually find that an alarming number of the progeny of those people who started 50 years ago are non-Jews. Alarming. Okay, you could actually, if you want to be sort of harsh about it, you could see it even here in town or in any town. You can ask the questions of those people that started that chapter of or that temple or whatever it is. What's gone on since then? If you fast forward over a 50-year period or a 25-year period, and you'll find alarming results. So the reality is that nothing is all or nothing, and I'm not writing any lines in the sand. But disengagement from Yiddishkeit, relative ignorance, unlettered apathy, leads to progeny that are non-Jews. How long does it take? Not more than 4 generations. Sometimes one, sometimes immediate, sometimes, right? But it leads to the end of the line. However, until you get to the end of the line, every person on the end of that line can make the U-turn. That's what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, fast forward, page 12. So setting the scene here, in case some have not read this or haven't read it recently, the way this book is written is that the rabbi and this David are having conversations. So David comes to see the rabbi and he says, basically, I'm a happy guy, but something's missing. And Rabbi Feldman asserts that the first conversation is like this one, and then the other conversations are about the details. So he wrote it in the order that he believes the conversation goes. So here, on page 12, he says something fascinating. He says... I'm near the top of the page. He says, I'm at the top of the page. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I'm feeling a lack of satisfaction or achievement in my life. I have achieved some material things, but somehow that doesn't seem to be enough. There's a certain nagging sense of discontent lurking in the background. I wouldn't call it unhappiness, at least not on the physical level. I'm a successful attorney. We have a nice home. We can afford more than most. We are healthy. But something inside is troubling me, and I'm really not quite sure what it is. It's a certain unease about life in general. I'm not sure why I feel this way or what's causing it. I'm going down a half of the paragraph to where it says, even when I'm on a pleasure trip or on a vacation, I have the feeling that something is missing. It all seems to lack purpose. I keep asking myself, what is it all about? I mean, I should be looking forward to a successful life, and yet I keep feeling that life is passing me by and that maybe I'm missing something important, but I'm not quite sure what it is. So there's an interesting study. I was actually interviewed briefly for this study that's in very much in its early stages about why people come back to traditional Judaism. In the 1950s in America, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, I once heard him say that in the 1950s in America, there were fewer than 10 people who could be described as Balei Tshuva, people who had been raised in non-observant homes that had become observant. Okay, that's a very small number, right? And you, yeah, and the whole, that's what he says. In the whole country, there were fewer than 10 people who had been raised in non-observant homes that had become observant. I have no way of questioning that or not. It wasn't around, right? But what I do know about that era is that most people believed that Orthodoxy in America was not going to last, that other forms of Judaism were going to swallow up Orthodoxy, just as people today believe that other forms of Judaism may not last, right? So life changes and generations change. But he said then that whereas now there are tens of thousands of people who fit the category of having been raised in a home that was not mitzvah observant and now are mitzvah observant. Colloquially, we refer to these as Balei Tshuva. Some people like that term. Some people don't like that term. I have no emotional relationship to that term, but it's a fair term because it's how we colloquially use it. It's, of course, a tremendous compliment to be called somebody who is penitent, right? And so today there are tens of thousands of Balei Tshuva, and the question is why? Very few serious academic studies have been done about this topic. There definitely is some incidence of people who are deeply unhappy. In other words, they come back to Yiddishkeit after jail or drug addiction or all kinds of challenges. Religion does have that role in people's lives, as we know, right? Religion of all kinds. But today, it sure doesn't look like that. You look at people who seem to have been happy. They had it all. They had it all, and yet, somehow or another, they made decisions to, like you all are making a decision right now to be at this class. You know, that's a decision to do something spiritual, intellectual, religious, traditional, from whatever you want, the term you want to use, it's a decision along that line. And what are we all doing here? So we all have very different reasons why we're here. It's an interesting question. One member of this shul said to me years ago, they're now fully observant family that wasn't several years ago, said, we weren't looking for Judaism because we were unhappy. We were just looking for the truth. And so that's one form. Other people are unhappy. But what I find most important in this little question that this particular David says is where he says, it all seems to lack a purpose. I keep asking myself, what's it all about? I mean, I should be looking forward to a successful life, and yet I keep feeling that life is passing me by, and that maybe I'm missing something important, but I'm not quite sure what it is. This is another, maybe too heavy statement for a first class, okay? But it's reality. So every one of us, if we were told by God, you have 2 months to live, and everyone here should be blessed with a long and healthy, fruitful life. If every person was told you have 2 months to live, people would live life very seriously. There's no doubt about it. If you said somebody, you have 1 week to live, people would make decisions very seriously about how they'd use the week. The reality is that however many weeks you have to live, it's just a collection of 1 week periods. It's just a collection of 2 month periods. And then, as the saying goes, there's taxes and there's death. In other words, the reality is that we all have a limited time here in this world. And life is passing us by, even if we're using it well, in a certain kind of a sense. And so, for this young man in the book, who's 30-ish, he's grabbing onto something because he says something's missing. If we have that feeling also, any one of us, then we can also grab onto something, whatever it may be in life, whatever it may be. You know, I'm very inspired by a couple that is no longer living. They lived here at the end of their lives. They used to daven in this shul from time to time. Their names were Bill and Bernice Frankel. I don't know if any of you ever met the Frankels. When they came here, they were very old people. In other words, they were both north of 90 when they arrived in this shul. And I love the story Mr. Frankel told me. I really love that man very much. He said that here was a man who was very successful. In other words, he retired as a New York City fireman on full pension, like at a very young age, 40-something, because he had been a fireman since he was like 20. And then he moved to Los Angeles and opened a plumbing business that became a very large business, all the while for 55 years receiving a pension from the city of New York. You know, and so he says he was 70-something years old when a man came to his door in Woodland Hills or something like that, you know, in that area of Los Angeles area, and said to him, he was coming for some kind of tzedakah or something like that, and said he wanted to point out something to him in the Chumash, in the Torah itself. He says, so I want to show you, give me your Chumash. So he says, he changed my life that day because I had no Chumash. I had no Chumash. I was embarrassed. I said, I have to buy a Chumash. Like, this can never happen to me again. So he says, he bought a Chumash. And before long, he just started learning. And from starting to learn, he said to himself at 75 or something like that, what's the difference whether I commit or I don't commit to putting on tefillin or whatever his particular thing was? But thank God, he had 20 plus more years of his life where he had become more, from his perspective, what more was defined as. He had taken on things that it's really never too late because we have only a collection of time here on this gift called life, right? So I guess like being out there, everybody should live and be well and be happy. On the other hand, most people don't ask those questions. They actually view life in more of a binary sense of, am I good or not good? Right? And so they say, I'm good. Things are good. Right? I am good. Most people say if the sort of story goes, I don't steal, I don't murder, I'm good. Right? But life is so much more nuanced than that, and we can grow and be more. Okay, so on page 13, this just reiterates this point, is that on page 13, near the top, second statement of David, he says, as I said, I'm a typical American Jew. I had a bar mitzvah. My Jewish education stopped there. I went on to high school, to university, got a graduate degree, am thoroughly familiar with the culture of the Western world. But as for Judaism, I barely remember how to recite a blessing over the Torah. Not only do I not know, I also do not observe many Jewish practices. We like the Hanukkah menorah, and we have a family Seder and go to synagogue on the high holidays, but that's about it. I like Jewish food, but I realize that hardly qualifies me as a good Jew. My tefillin, brand new and untouched, are still in my drawer. My wife usually lights candles on Friday night, but to be honest, our Friday night is just like every other night, except that we have gefilte fish and chicken. Now, I know that doesn't describe anybody around this table, but it describes countless people that you know, right? And what does describe most of us, really, not only at this table, but most of the American Jewish picture, to the exclusion of very few, actually, is that most American Jews are more likely to have a graduate degree than have advanced Jewish knowledge. They put first secular education. And I come from a family like that, which is good. And I have, I think a very good secular education, though I must admit that among the children of my family, I'm the only one without a graduate degree.
The only
one with no graduate degree. I did the unthinkable. I was accepted to 3 graduate schools and moved to Phoenix instead. I don't regret it at all. But the point is that
isn't it becoming a...
Yeah, I mean, I have a religious... Okay. I have a graduate degree in religion,
okay.
I suppose, yeah. So thank you for that. Now I can go to sleep tonight feeling better about myself. Thank you. But the point is that this is a sad reality of American life, even among the relatively observant, and even among many of the observant, that is hard to understand why Jews are very, very driven, and yet they allow the Yiddishkeit to be almost not driven at all. You can commonly go to a funeral where the young man or middle-aged man who's the mourner for his parent that passed away has trouble reading the Kaddish, though he has every achievement outside of that. So I only bring this up because so much of the fading goes away from just education. Education, and not in a binary sense of, well, the Judaism's good enough, but there's never good enough on the achievement side of what really counts, right? Because it depends on what really counts, and I'm not going to make an assessment either way. I think both really count, you know? But this is something that, again, it just underscores the importance of education. That the people, you know, somebody once said to me, I once described to somebody what was going to be written, what I would like to see written on my gravestone. And the person's response to me was, but that's all in Hebrew. That's all in Hebrew. I said, what do you want? I said, well, maybe you should have English letters because you may have descendants that don't read Hebrew. I said, I got bigger problems than their ability to read my gravestone. If my descendants don't read Hebrew, the last thing I'm worried about is whether they can read my gravestone. Like, in other words, I gotta address that because of how big a deal that is, not because they can't read my gravestone. So quite the opposite. Maybe that was the day I decided it will all be in Hebrew. Maybe. All right, who knows? But I'm just saying, we have to put first and foremost this element of education. And that's really the thrust of this chapter more than any, about education. See, I think there's a lot of borrowed little phrases in Jewish lore that people use to claim that Judaism believes in the thing that I believe in. You know, I wrote this down actually here. I want to find the page it's on. Fast forward to page 20, where on page 20, it says like this. If the inner yearning is so universal, the rabbi has made the point that people want to transcend. So the fellow David says, if the inner yearning is so universal, how is it that more Jews don't reach out to return to their faith? Why is it only a trickle? Because there is good news and there's bad news. The good news is that there's thousands of people who do want to learn. And in this room right now, there's this many people, right? But of course, there could be 1,000 times the number of us, right, in the room who would want to learn tonight, and they're not. So the rabbi responds, says, good point. I think it's because there are some special character traits which distinguish every returnee, traits which are not very common. Honesty, fortitude, and courage. So on the way to answering the point that we were just discussing, I want to interrupt at this point, which is, that's awesome. And I want to tell you something. As a rabbi who's been around a lot of people who've grown in their Yiddishkeit over the 13 years that we live here and the 11 years or almost 11 years of this shul, I have seen time and time and time again people making difficult decisions. Not oh, the Torah lesson was so profound that they had to. How could they not have made this? No, the people who have decided to sacrifice X, Y, or Z, to wake up early in the morning, to go to sleep late at night, to spend more money on their kids' tuition than they ever imagined they would do, whatever the decision has been, to sell their house in one neighborhood, move to another, whatever the decision has been, whatever hard it is, dress differently, I don't care what it is. That is nothing other than their honesty, fortitude, and courage. It is hard to make those decisions, and so the gap really between those who grow and those who don't grow is their own courage, is their own fortitude, right? Every one of us is going to go to sleep tonight a little bit later than we might have if we didn't come to learn Torah tonight. It's a decision you made, and you should be proud of it, right? And every one of us is spending more money on Judaism for whatever way we support the Jewish world, either whether through tuition or shul membership or tzedakah or whatever it is, money that we could use for vacation, right? So, and what is the gap between the people who do those things? Not that their rabbi is cooler, right? Or more inspiring. Fortitude and hard decisions. Now, I haven't forgotten your point, Paul. After all, you have to be honest and gutsy to say to yourself and to others, my past has not been perfect and I need to make a course correction. Conversely, the returnees all lack certain other character traits. Smugness, complacency, self-satisfaction. These are the great stumbling blocks to genuine return, or to use the Hebrew term that I'll define in a few moments, tshuva. The Torah often refers to such people as those whose hearts are uncircumcised, meaning that there is an outer shell insulating their innermost yearnings, that they refuse to open themselves to any kind of sanctity. Smugness and self-centeredness are particularly deadly in the religious life. Okay, finishing that paragraph, I realize that I didn't get that it's lower down on the page to the point that I wanted to address. Lower down on the page, he says, what about the majority of Jews, the ones whose Jewishness consists of almost nothing? Are they going to disappear? So we've already addressed this to some degree in the opening. Listen to how the rabbi says. That's a very serious and painful problem. To the vast majority of Jews, their personal Jewishness is totally irrelevant. Now, again, that's nobody in this room, but it is the vast majority of Jews. They scarcely, note, in our city, there's about 20,000 seats occupied on any kind of high holiday service. Everybody says there's 100,000 Jews here. Do you know that means that 8 out of 10 Jews don't go to whatever you consider the shul you would never go to? They also consider the shul they would never go to. They just don't go to any other one. Okay? So they don't go anywhere. They go to work. They go to the golf course. They don't go anywhere. So to the vast majority of Jews, their personal Jewishness is totally irrelevant. They scarcely give it a thought except in times of crisis. They are caught up in the noise and cacophony and speed and rush of our day. Some of them seem to be going through life in a stupor, like robots thinking only in sound bites, and that is not thinking. Their only connection with their own heritage is that thin, tenuous thread of ethnicity I mentioned before, pride in the state of Israel, the fear of anti-Semitism, attending synagogue from time to time. That becomes the end-all and be-all of their Judaism. I'll add my own words in here, that for a very large portion of Americans, religion has only one role in their lives, funerals. Funerals are the only place where religion plays.
Why do they think that's so important?
It's fascinating. People, the majority of funerals in America, the vast majority of funerals in America, are still religious services among people who have no religion at all.
Yeah.
So funerals are still a place where religion has a say. Fascinating thing. I don't know, maybe because when you're faced with death, if you don't think about religion, the only other alternative is it's all over.
But you're not facing death, you put in somebody else.
Yeah, I'm just saying that at death, if you don't deal with it in any religious framework, then all you have to deal with it is within maggots and worms.
Well, does it have something to do with, the idea that, that person who's passed away is going on to a higher place?
That's what I'm saying. It has to have that. Otherwise, you're stuck with the alternative. And the alternative is dirt. Mm-hmm. That's the only, right? So that's a tough alternative.
Or guilt.
Yeah. Okay, so I didn't forget your point yet, Paul.
They might feel guilty that they're not burying their parents or grandparents properly. They know better, but
it's an interesting thing because those people. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing because again, the vast majority of America today has only one role for religion in their lives, which is funerals. Fascinating thing. It's amazing, right?
I heard Rabbi Wine tell a story where he said when his father was a rabbi in Chicago, a gangster died, Jewish gangster. His father got a call from the family and said they wanted him to officiate at the funeral. Rabbi Wine said, well, what do you say at a funeral for a gangster? You know, he
right.
Say something. So even a gangster thinks that he...
Everyone. I mean, you see it. You, if you know anybody Jewish, there's a higher likelihood of a Jewish funeral than a bris milah. Even though the bris milah is a very high likelihood also, right? But it's an amazing thing. Amazing, fascinating thing. Fascinating.
Don't you think also the bar mitzvah? I mean, most of the people who are on the fringe, their children will either be bar or bat mitzvah.
I think that there's a large number, but I think it's a far larger number. I think, let me put it like this. When people die, I have never known a Jewish person who died, personally. I've never known a Jewish person who died who had a absolutely secular funeral. Never heard of it. I've never heard of justice of the peace. They've had secular marriages. They've had everything.
Exactly.
But I've never heard of it.
And the priest is done by the doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, the cutting.
I never heard of it. I just never heard of it. I'm not saying, it doesn't mean that when it says in lieu of flowers sent to whatever, it doesn't mean it's a Jewish cause. But I'm saying rabbis and Jewish cemeteries and that still have a hold. And I think that's true about Catholics and Lutherans and everybody else also. They're fascinating. I don't know, by the way, I'm bringing up a big point and I don't know the answer to it. I don't know the answer to it. Okay, let's go back to the writing. So I just point out that becomes the end-all and be-all of their Judaism, and I interjected that funerals still seem to play a role. And go back to the rabbi's words. This magnificent, top of 21, this magnificent, majestic faith of ours gets diluted to nothing more than a Boy Scout code of behavior. Support Israel and help old ladies cross the street. Quintessential Feldman. I am not against helping anyone cross the street. But there is more to this 4,000-year-old religion of ours than nostalgia, gefilte fish, and being a pleasant person. I mean, you can be a pleasant atheist, too. Most Jews were never taught that there are certain demands made of us as Jews, that we have certain obligations. A bright but uninformed Jewish college student once told me that what she most appreciates about Judaism is that it makes no demands on you, that it lets you live your life as you want to. This is pathetic nonsense, but so she was taught in her Sunday school. Okay, now, this evokes the words of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch from about 150 years ago, a little more than that, 150 years ago, so, where he referred to non-traditional Judaism as a random patchwork of Jewish symbols. And this is the point I was making before, that huge numbers of Jews want to throw Jewish labels at their own values. They're having a party. It involves grandparents. It's called the Dorvador. They're having environmentalism something, a recycling event. It's called Tikkun Olam. They get a college degree. It's called People of the Book. Right? Their own values, they assign Jewish labels with a random patchwork of menorahs, Jewish stars. I find the use of the Lador Vador the best one, actually. Well, Tikkun Olam is even better, because Tikkun Olam really means nothing like how it's used in the vernacular, you know, popular sense. And I'm not here to criticize. I'm going to make the point in a second. But Lador Vador is an interesting one, because I actually did my own little study of where the phrase Lador Vador or Dor Vador, wherever that phrase is found, it's found in the coronation of God. Lador Vador Nagid Godlecha Ulenetzach Netzachim Kiddushas Chanakdish. From generation to generation, you know, we'll speak of your greatness, God. Dor Lador Yishabach Maasecha Ugvorasecha Yagidu. From generation to generation, they'll talk about your actions, God. They'll praise your actions. Every time you phrase it, Yimloch Hashem l'olam l'chayach zion l'dor v'dor, hallelujah, God will reign forever, for generation to generation. It doesn't mean a, you know, Sunday in the park that was grandparents' day. Doesn't mean that. And yet you see that. I actually saw it in a most vulgar sense recently. I see it all the time. You see violations of the Torah where they borrow Jewish catchphrases to assign their own values to it, to say, Tselem Elohim, created in the image of God. Or, I can't even repeat the one that I just saw on the walls of the holy city of Jerusalem 10 days ago when I was in Yerushalayim. Well, I will repeat it. You know, Jerusalem for all generations has been called the city of David, Ir David. There's a little part of Yerushalayim that's specifically known as Ir David, but Yerushalayim has always been called Ir David. I saw spray painted on the walls, you know Yerushalayim well, it was near Nachlaot. Yeah, I saw spray painted on the walls in several different places, the words Ir David v'Yehonatan, the city of David and Jonathan. You understand that that's just an abuse of the words of the prophet to make a political position about which the Supreme Court most recently ruled. That's what that they're using. Now, I'm not coming to make any claim on that, but just say what you want to say. Why have to borrow random patchwork of Jewish symbols and throw it on the wall? It is a sensitive issue. It is a sensitive issue. It's a big issue. I'm not getting into that. But the patchwork of how Jewish organizations want to throw around little phrases, right? The rabbi here in this book says, there's a goal and destiny to Jewish life. There's God and prayer and opportunities to connect with God. There's a sense of holiness to life. There's a guidebook called Torah. There are relationships to God and to other people. Judaism is not always comfortable. There is sacrifice and there are things and issues for which you have to be prepared to give up your life. There is discipline and rigor. There is a way to behave and a way not to behave. There are boundaries, lines, and limits. There are challenges every step of the way. What I'm saying is that being Jewish is a serious business. If all we have to sustain us are pap, platitudes, cliches, and sweet humanistic sentiments, we will self-destruct as a people, or at best be left with a tiny number of committed Jews, while the rest of our people fall over the edge into the black hole of ignorance, Jewish illiteracy, intermarriage assimilation, self-indulgence, and Jewish nothingness, which is exactly what is happening to most of us. So I can go on and on about this point, but that's where we borrow little things, and then we have to allow Judaism to speak to us, rather than we speak to Judaism and then borrow from it cute labels, cute symbols, right? So there's no doubt you could have a car service with a Jewish name that's open on Yom Kippur. You know, there's no doubt, right? That's guaranteed, right? And that's what makes it Jewish. Right, so, and on and on. I feel like I'm being a little bit too negative. I'm not trying to be negative. The hour is late, I think. It's 9:02. I want to just continue a few more minutes. So let's go to 22 and 23. So I wrote two big asterisks in my notes. One of them is here. If I were going to sum up the thrust of this message in this, he's much more encouraging than I've been, I think. But here, near the bottom of 22, David says, so what should we Jews do? And the rabbi responds, first we need to understand that what is happening to us today is not because we Jews have made a deliberate decision to jump the ship of Judaism. It's not that we have tried the Torah and found it wanting. It's that most Jews have never tried the Torah. Jews today do not abandon Judaism with forethought. They simply follow the mob, take the line of least resistance, and because they don't recognize the cause of the gnawing within them, they drop out of Judaism. They leave after the entree, they don't stay for the full meal, and they never experience the satisfaction of being a Jew. Let me say it again, the core reason for today's dropout from Jewish life is Jewish ignorance, a lack of any Jewish knowledge beyond the most elementary level. And the only way to combat this hemorrhaging from our ranks is to take Jewish learning seriously. Most Jews feel that studying the Bible or Hebrew or learning Jewish practices is for children, as if it were some bitter medicine that only children have to take in order to become bar or bat mitzvah. Let me interject and say like this. A lot of studies have been done about this, that in America, the incidence of Jewish involvement in people's lives goes on a steady decline from their bar mitzvah, coming back up a little bit in college, and then it's at its worst after college, and it remains low through marriage until they have a kid. And then when they have a kid, boom, they want to have Hanukkah candles and preschool. And it's very interesting. It's a very interesting phenomenon. But what ends up is that Torah study is relegated to children. Only children should be of concern about Moshe and Aaron and Miriam. Right, that's what's going on in most of the Jewish world.
Why do you think why do you think it's happened? I mean, obviously there's the children. You have a foundation in your family. You grew up Orthodox or whatever or not. You became a bar mitzvah. But yes, I know we both have seen the decline in youth, definitely engaging in Yiddishkeit, going to shul and all of that. But why do you think that's happening?
Okay, so there's more than one answer to your question. The first thing is I think there are natural realities of increased temptation. Mm-hmm. In other words, when you're 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, there's probably a decrease in all good behaviors, not just Judaism. There's a desire to make your own way and not do what your parents tell you and to discover the opposite gender and all kinds of things that make people tempted when they're teenagers. So teenagers make a lot of bad decisions. So that they make this bad decision also, I don't think is specific only to that. That's number one. Number two is that within the families in which it's probably most... And I want to make the point that therefore I think that extends even into the firm world where it's hard. It's hard to be a loyal son or a loyal daughter to the Ribono Shel Olam when you want to watch that movie that you shouldn't watch, when you want to, have that experience you want to have, whatever it may be.
You want to text on Shabbos.
Yeah, well, that has to do with addiction. That primarily has to do with addiction.
I read an article about that in the OU magazine.
Yeah, so that's a big problem in the modern Orthodox community, very big problem, huge problem. But that has to do with addiction. That has to do with brain stimulation and the endorphin rush. You know when you're a little kid, you can't wait to get the mail because maybe there'll be a piece of mail for you. And if you get a piece of mail, it's awesome. Then you grow up, and if you get a piece of mail, it's probably a bill, so you're not interested, right? Then everything goes away from the mail except the bills, right? That's what happened now, right? So a kid who has a package come to them, right? So that endorphin rush that we all feel when we're noticed and what's going on might be the single biggest impact of these little machines, not the content of the machines, but the thrill, the charge of being touched, of being contacted. So if you do that 24/7, if you do it 24/6, it's extremely difficult to not do it 24/7, right? So that is a tough situation that the community has to grapple with harshly because that has to do with addiction more so. But having said that, you make a lot of bad decisions as a teenager because you want things that you're not supposed to have.
Right. Don't you think a lot of influence are the peer groups, the friends that one has?
Sure. Yeah.
That might have more of an influence than the family.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. And that's why I think that at that age, whatever the specific age is going to vary a little bit from kid to kid, you're exactly right. The primary influence in their life goes from what had been their parents to their friends, right? And that is why the right friends is the most important thing. That's underscores the point about Jewish education, because otherwise, what are you putting your kids into or your whatever? It's a problem. It underscores the incredible importance. I am a huge believer in camp. Camp is a way of not making the kids what we say. There's a Hebrew and Yiddish word, hefker. It's like ownerless for 2 months in the summer. And then camp is a very intense Usually camp is a spirited, intense, good Jewish experience. And by the way, that crosses all Jewish lines. In the Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox world, camp is better than year-round. Mm-hmm. Camp is better. There's no comparison, actually. What the average Conservative kid gets on Shabbos in camp as opposed to during the year, profoundly different. Unbelievably different. So, you know, Tisha B'Av, if you don't go to camp, you know, the 3 weeks, so on and on I could speak about camp, because then you're in the right thing and you've got the right kids and it's the right environment and all that. So that's the first thing I would say, is that on the other part, though, is more insidious, which is that there's tremendous status associated with Bar and Bat Mitzvah for the parents. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they kill their kids, you know, to say to the kids, I sacrifice nothing for Judaism, but you have to sacrifice Sunday mornings and Tuesday nights, you know. And that's a disaster waiting to happen. I used to joke when I was the director of the Kollel that let me tell you a story. Does it sound? And I told him this story. Does it sound autobiographical? Yeah, it sounds biographical. So I say, so the Kollel, when I was the director, my line was, if you want to understand what we do, we're in Hebrew school rehab. That's what we do. You know, we offer you know, good serious Jewish education for adults. So anyway, back to the point though. I think that there's nothing holding them. Now, what then reintroduces them when their kids are born is that most people get it, that if you give your kids absolutely nothing, they will have absolutely nothing. They just don't know how much is enough. They think enough is until 6 years old, or then they think enough is until 10 years old, or then they think enough is until 13 years old. But I would argue today, having been the product of a modern Orthodox upbringing, okay, that for the modern Orthodox community over the last 20 years, there's been a much larger shift away from classical four-year colleges. Like when I went to high school, my friends and I, nobody went to YU. Nobody went to Jewish college, except for those of us who went off the deep end, like me, right? So, but nobody went to Jewish college of the kids we grew up with in Chicago. They went to Wisconsin and Michigan and Columbia and Penn and Harvard and Maryland, et cetera. Okay? That has shifted a lot, because what the parent group used to believe until 12th grade is enough, now there's a parent group that believes that that's not enough, because adolescence goes later, because adulthood starts later, because they just look at the drop-off rates in all those universities that they used to be running after. Right, and then there's another thing, which is you can get into the best graduate schools in the country from any university, as long as you do well. So they, you know, so these are the things that are in play there. These are the things that are in play there.
And Rabbi, I would also go take to that point to take it like a little sidestep further, and I'm not going to speak to high school and college, but from, you know, like in the you know, the elementary and middle school area, mm-hmm. it's also the quality of the Jewish exposure, not just the quantity, because, you know, I can speak for, I'll speak for, you know, my wife and I, you know, for Karen and I, those that don't know us, our whatever our story, you know, we had our kids in Sunday school, and they were fighting us, I don't want to go, and all of a sudden that light bulb turned on, wait a minute, they don't want to go because we don't want to go, we don't want to do it. So it was when we started doing more, that they said, hey, mom and dad are doing more. Okay, it's not so bad. So it's not necessarily forcing them to go to Sunday school. It's forcing them to go to, or forcing them to have exposure. It's the right exposure.
Sure. I mean, the average Sunday school student for sure has never heard of Pinchas or Bullock. You know, this week's parsha and last week's, they've not even heard of it. Not the average, everyone. You know, everyone has not heard of Pinchas or Bullock, right? So what are they getting at the end of the day is, only from A to D. I can go on and on.
Okay.
I want to exactly. So I want to finish with one point, and then the hour is late and we'll stop. Page 29. On page 29, David says in his second statement on 29. You said before that tshuva applies to righteous people as well as sinners, but surely the tshuva of a pious, God-fearing person is much different than that of a person who has never known anything about Judaism or God or Torah and has never in his life practiced anything of his ancestral religion. these two types of tshuva must differ quite radically. Quite true, an individual who is basically religious, observant, and knowledgeable may feel that he is not praying with the proper intensity or devotion, or that he is not as fully conscious of God's presence throughout his day as he should be, or that he has grown casual in his observance of the mitzvot, and he resolves to make a more serious commitment to God. That was always the classic sense of tshuva. Nowadays, however, the term by and large refers to those who have wandered far off the path of Torah and who now want to put their lives into reverse. They want to turn around and go in the opposite direction. One of the key elements in classical tshuva, the kind every Jew is required always to do, and particularly prior to Yom Kippur, is to renounce certain misdeeds of the past and to resolve not to repeat them. But today's returnee is not just renouncing a few misdeeds. He's renouncing his entire life until now. He's stating in effect that he wants to be a different person, which involves breaking habits and instincts and changing his whole approach to life. It's like moving from one planet to another. And here's the point that I really want to drive home. That's why I feel that today's returnee is truly heroic, because an entire new way of life has to be absorbed. A great deal of new learning has to take place. A new way of looking at the world and at people and at oneself, one's own self. There is much to discover. It takes time, and the path is often convoluted and complex. Suddenly relating to one's fellow human being takes on a new dimension. Suddenly God has a new presence in one's life. Suddenly the Torah's viewpoint has to be taken into account. And all the time one has to battle instinct, inertia, habit, and the natural human urge not to change and not to move in new directions. Plus the raised eyebrows and often outright opposition and antagonism of family and friends. This requires a huge amount of inner strength and conviction. So this is a big deal. This is a really, really big deal. And people, we all should rethink to some degree. You know, people will say about a certain family or a certain person or whatever it is, yeah, they did that because or whatever it is, and like as if we know what goes into each person's decision. You know, people used to say about the great, unbelievable Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who passed away a year and a half ago. You say about Rabbi Ovadia, he had a photographic memory, so he knew the whole Torah. If you read one page of the writings of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, on every page, I would bet, of his writings, he quotes verbatim a book I have not even heard of. Okay? And the thing is that there are two ingredients. Let's say he had a photographic memory. He also decided at the age of about 5 that he would use his entire life to study Torah and not be interested in anything else. He didn't know who was in the World Series or what the markets were doing or what the weather was going to be like in Timbuktu. He didn't care. He knew everything, but he didn't know things that one shouldn't know. So what I'm trying to draw out is that we can make excuses that people have this going for them, whatever. You know what he had? Unbelievable will. And that's what people who return to Yiddishkeit also have. Unbelievable will to take on the raised eyebrows of their friends and family. And I'm sure I'm speaking in your own lives. You have this, you know, where people say, well, why do you act that way or have to do it that way? Or now we can't eat together or whatever it may be. And it's heroic to overcome the inertia of society and take life seriously and do big things. It's really heroic. And the rabbi points out on a different spot that the people today who are making these decisions, they're not sinners. To be sinners, they'd have to be tremendously knowledgeable and flouting God's will. Most people are just not exposed to it. And so when they take on things that they were and now newly exposed to, you know, it's nothing short of heroism in the act of their own free will that should be really admired and respected. Okay, we shall continue next week, Yemiyetz Hashem, with the second chapter. You can purchase the book at artscroll.com if you like, or probably at Amazon or something like that.